This is The Guardian.
Inflation is down. The government's plan is allegedly working. And Rishi Sunak wants us to know this.
We need to stick to the plan to deliver a brighter future for our country.
This week, Jeremy Hunt got most of the way to confirming that the government is aiming at an October election. That's 7 months away. The Conservative Party seems to be locked into a state of chaos and tension, while Labour wants to get into power by saying as little as possible.
That in a more dangerous world, we must be clear-eyed about where trade-offs exist.
So how is this zombie phase of politics going to play out? And can everyone really hang on that long? I'm John Harris, and you're listening to Politics Week, the UK for The Guardian. Joining me today are the former Number 10 Director of Communications and host of the Desperately Seeking Wisdom podcast, Sir Craig Oliver, and The Guardian columnist, Gabby Hinsliff. Hello to you both.
Hello, John.
Hello.
Craig, your podcast, it seems to me, has an undercurrent of finding solace away from politics. That's broadly right, isn't it?
Yeah, broadly. I mean, basically what the idea was that fairly late in life, I sort of discovered that I wasn't feeling brilliant about everything. And I wanted to have a look around and see what I could find and talk to some interesting people. So we talked to lots of interesting people about what they've learned from life. And next week we're doing Trevor MacDonald.
I'm sorry to drag you back into the slightly squalid, testy world of politics for the next 30 minutes. But as you'll find out, there are good reasons for that. Let's talk about this idea of a zombie parliament, a zombie government, arguably, and how it feels looking into the 7 months ahead that we may have until there's an October election. It feels a bit like a monotonous slog to me, particularly in the face of near certainty about the result of the election. I mean, you can sense that lots of other people have come to the same conclusion by the sheer number of Tory MPs who are standing down. Maybe this is like the political equivalent of a 12-hour wait in A&E. Does it feel like that to you, Gabby?
12 hours in A&E? Lucky if it's only 12
hours.
I mean, yeah, I have to say, I don't sort of view the next, if it is another 7 months, I don't view that with a huge amount of enthusiasm. But it often gets like this in the kind of last leg of a parliament that everyone is dying and no one can quite put out of their misery. It does remind me, it wasn't as bad, but the last week has reminded me of the sort of end of the Brown government when you had this last flurry of Labour MPs thinking, oh God, Gordon is going to lose this and can we replace him with someone? And there was a sort of last Blairite flurry of attempts to replace him, first with David Miliband and then with, I think at the end, the candidate they ended up with at one point was Jeff Hoon.
At that
point,
you just thought,
yeah, and at that point, you just thought, it's this. Guys, this is not, it's too late for this. You know, you cannot bail yourself out of this at this point. And so it proved.
We should remind younger listeners that Jeff Hoon, bless him, was the sort of somewhat boring embodiment of the arse end of the new Labour government, really, wasn't he?
No shade on Jeff Hoon, but he was probably not the nation's choice.
Now, Craig, are there comparisons here with your time in government? You were head of communications at Downing Street until 2016?
Just after Brexit, basically, yeah.
Okay, the Brexit referendum. In 2014, The Guardian was talking about a zombie parliament limping into its final year. We had the Fixed Term Parliament Act in those days. So there was this sense of 2015 inevitably coming, the coalition slowly moving into sort of divorce mode. And not much going on? Was that the way you remember
it? I do think it's slightly different in that there was a fixed-term parliament act there where the Liberal Democrats and the Conservatives had signed up to this idea of having a five-year fixed-term parliament. And subsequent to that, nobody's really stuck to it. But they kind of felt, or we kind of felt, that having said that we were going to do it, that you had to stick to it. What I think is going on here is slightly different. When governments look like they are going to lose, lots and lots of people have a vested interest in saying, look, let's get on with it. If you look at the current Conservative Party, there's a whole load of MPs who are like, I'm leaving, I'm done. I wish I could just change and it'd be done. Then there's a whole load of people who think, if we keep leaving it too long, there's more chance of me losing. And then there's other people who think, I've got a good chance of winning my seat and I'd rather be in a circumstance where we just had the debate now and the fight now. That applies to a lot of Conservative MPs, but there's one Conservative MP it doesn't apply to, and that's Rishi Sunak. Rishi
right.
Sunak is looking at the polls and going, I'm 20 points behind. If I call an election now, I'm going to get probably eviscerated. I need to follow the Mr. Micawber strategy of hoping that something turns up. And if I walk off the board now, then I guarantee my fate. But if I leave it going another 7 months, then maybe, just maybe, something will turn up. So his interests are not the same as everybody else's in this.
Okay. But in your guts as a political observer, a close political observer, which I'm sure you are, then what's your sense of the next 7 months and, you know, how it's going to make you feel? I just feel like, what on earth is there of interest that's going to keep us going through this period?
I think we are going to be in a very, very painful campaign mode for the next 7 months. And you're going to see probably the very worst of politics in that time. I look at my social media feed and I see all of the parties at the moment just releasing utter nonsense. I'm afraid we're going to get a lot of this for the next 7 months. It's going to be very painful. And what we expect to be the outcome, I'm sure, will be the result.
You're cheering me up already. The other historical comparison clearly is with the dying years of the John Major government in the 1990s. That similarly had a sense of a very troubled government, lots of internecine tension and this slow winding down. But even compared with the John Major period, it seems to me, the level of internecine tension, bickering and falling out and leadership pitches in the Conservative Party at the moment is something else again. Maybe that's sort of stoked up by what Brexit did to the sort of collective Conservative mind, but it's clearly made worse by the sense that a leadership election has already started. We've seen another eruption of plotting this week. It seems like the 57th.
I'm not sure you're right on that, John. I was a very young reporter or producer on ITN then, and there was a political editor called Michael Brunson who did an interview with John Major. And caught off camera, but the microphone still on, was the Prime Minister talking about the bastards in his party. And ITN had it. I remember being a junior producer and watching my bosses decide whether or not they were going to use this. And they decided, yeah, we're going to use it. But that was a symptom of quite how bad it was. There was a lot of expectation that Michael Portillo was going to jump in and have a challenge, all sorts of things going on there. So I think that we tend to always think it's worse now, but actually then that was pretty much as bad as it got.
I think the impression that it's at a more extreme level is just because the news cycle works differently now and rumour takes on a huge amount of weight and momentum because of the fact everyone's on their phones all the time and all that. That definitely sort of has a sort of hothouse effect, doesn't it, on the state?
The news cycle moves faster now, certainly because of social media, because of, you know, all of those things mean that, you know, in the space of 24 hours, you can go through an entire intense sort of range of speculation from Penny Mordaunt's going to be walking into number 10 in 5 minutes to know that was all a load of rubbish. You know, it can happen in the space of about 3 hours.
It was about 8 hours,
which,
that one,
you know, and that probably does intensify the feelings. But it's interesting. I mean, this week it does feel like a huge amount of thrashing about to produce, really, at the end of it, you know, nothing has changed.
Can you talk us through the thrashing then?
Well, the thrashing, you know, it started with, in the Sunday papers, with, it was the Mail on Sunday, I think, that ran the story saying, oh, Penny Mordaunt could be the compromise candidate that everyone can rally behind.
Because she's going to have a 100-day contract with the nation or something.
There's been this discussion that, you know, you can't have another, even the Conservative Party accepts you can't have another leadership contest now. So it would have to be someone who could be, you know, pronounced by acclamation, a bit like Michael Howard was as leader, except of course Michael Howard was in opposition, not in government. It's a lot easier to do that kind of thing when you're in opposition. But anyway, that you needed someone that everyone could agree on, and you know, Penny Mordaunt was apparently the one. And it wasn't coming, as far as I could tell, from the Mordaunt camp itself, which is, it was coming from, most of this has been coming from right-wing MPs who A, are most unreconciled to Sunak to start with, they never wanted him, and secondly are arguably most at risk of losing their seats in a wipeout. And what they really want is someone who'll hold the ring until the actual election, not lose quite as badly as Sunak would have, and then just lose their seat and wander off into the wilderness, allowing whoever actually, the right winger who actually wants to be leader, to become leader.
But weren't they trying to throw Penny Mordaunt under the bus, so to speak, in the sense that they were talking up her being on manoeuvres and thrustingly ambitious in order to undermine her chances after the election?
This person, well, I'm sure that's part of it, but the other part of it is, and they've now moved on to suggesting that Tom Tugendhat is the sort of
it's hard to keep up,
person. Again, you know, what you're saying essentially is that nobody who really wants to be leader now, because you're not going to have time to change anything for the election. You're just going to lose. You'll be the shortest, you know, lived leader since Liz Truss. That's no good. So what they want is some stand-in. And you're basically saying someone who's not actually good enough to be the leader, but you could be like a caretaker leader to the election. So what you're being offered is 7 months of taking all the flak and doing all the miserable stuff in return for not being leader.
Here's a question, Craig. How do you think Rishi Sunak is doing? I don't mean emotionally. I mean as a prime minister, although you can bring his emotions into it if you want.
I think that when history is written and when we look back over this time, we'll probably look back and say it was probably lost before he became prime minister. And that the reality is that the Conservative Party couldn't do something like Partygate and then nearly bust the entire pension system of the country through Liz Truss and survive it. And I suspect what we're going through is a period where the British public have decided it's over, we're moving on, and they're just waiting until the election is called. And I think you can see
And in that context, how do you think he's doing? All right, it's a very difficult job, obviously.
Well, I think you can see a pattern of behaviour where he's throwing and grasping at lifelines consistently. So I think if you look back to since the Conservative Party conference last year, he suddenly tried to present himself as the change candidate. Then he brings in David Cameron. Then he says it's all going to be on the budget. Then he says it's all going to be on Rwanda. Each of these things hasn't worked. And I think the needle isn't moving. And if it is moving at all, it's moving backwards. So I think that he is basically discovering that actually the gravity was always going to be pulling him only in one direction. I don't think anybody in this circumstance would have done wonderfully or brilliantly. I think he's made some mistakes. I think he's learning on the job, and he's learning some pretty difficult lessons on the job that David Cameron probably had a few years to sort out, and he didn't. I don't think that we would have dealt with the Hester story in the way that he has done, but a lot of that...
How would you have done it differently?
Well, when you're a director of communications in Downing Street, you've got to be able to sift out what are the red flag issues. And I think that for me, when I saw that, this is an instant red flag. There's no way you're going to get away without actually fully dealing with that. And at that
moment, make your mind up, move quick.
Yeah, at that moment, you've got to get to the Prime Minister, say, this is a serious problem. We need a line to take. And that line to take has got to be able to endure contact with reality.
When the Hester thing happened, I had a memory straight away of David Cameron, and therefore this must have involved you, and his reaction to the first stirrings of the expenses scandal. And he, as I recall it, he just moved really quick, and he was given credit for doing that. That's right, isn't it?
What's right is that I wasn't involved in that. It was actually my predecessor, because it was when he was in opposition.
Andy Coulson.
But right. He paid a very, very high price for that, because actually lingering on into my time of working in the office was a lot of MPs felt that they had been thrown under the bus by him. Now, he would say, I think, looking back, that it was net the right thing to do. But what he learned from that is that sometimes there are situations where there is no right answer. It's about damage limitation and making sure you're in a position where you're suffering the minimal amount of damage. I think the Hester situation was that. It had already been damaging. It needed to be said very quickly and cleanly. This is racist, misogynistic, unacceptable. Actually, we are going to keep the money because, by the way, we can't give it back. But that is our line, and we're going to stick by it and move on. And instead, you had this kind of faffing about for several days. And it was only when a black female cabinet minister, Kemeny Badenoch, came out and said it was racist that they changed their line.
Gabby, there's no coherent programme to speak of as far as this government is concerned. I read the other day that the working day for MPs in the House of Commons has been shorter on average in this parliamentary session than in any other in the past quarter century, right? Now, again, that's nothing new. We can dredge up examples from the past that broadly fit the same picture. It feels odd, doesn't it, to have a government that doesn't know what it's doing or where it's going or what its strategy is.
There's certainly not much of a legislative programme, and that doesn't necessarily mean the government then doesn't have a programme, but there's certainly not much of a legislative programme. If you think of all the times that Rishi Sunak has set out, you know, I mean, a year ago we had these are my five priorities on which you judge me, you know, so there was an idea that there was a sort of Rishi Sunak plan and that we were going to be taken through it. Obviously, a lot of those pledges then were not met. And since then, we've had various sort of attempts to restate what, you know, Rishi Sunak's priorities are or plans are, which all kind of taper away into this feeling that what they're really doing is kind of waiting for something to turn up that they can turn to their advantage rather than actually governing. You can see funding problems building up in all sorts of sectors, that it's almost as if government is thinking, park that, that's someone else's problem. You know, if we can just keep this ticking over for 6 months, it'll all crash under the watch of the next government.
Isn't the other thing, because the Conservative Party is in such a sort of volatile, disordered state, one minute you're getting Lee Anderson, the next minute it's Frank Hester, the next minute everyone's saying Kemi Badenoch's on manoeuvres, it often feels like the government really exists to protect the government. Its business or its sort of foreground is completely consumed by its own problems. It feels a bit to me like that famous sign that said, don't throw stones at this notice. You know, it's sort of this weird circular logic of government for government's sake.
I think we're circling around an issue here, which is that actually the problem is it feels like it's all campaigning all the time and not very much governing. And And I think that that is a kind of disease that certainly entered into the Conservative Party since Brexit. I think that the Labour Party thinks that actually, as well with its small target strategy, that kind of thing, that actually it's all about campaigning and just carrying the vase across the floor. But I think that what has happened in politics is that what was, I think something like Rwanda is a really good example of this. Something that essentially was a campaigning gimmick has become defining of the program of the government. And actually, Rishi Sunak is on record as having said, look, I don't think this is a great idea. But it's come to define him because there are people surrounding him who think that the only thing to do is to just campaign all of the time.
But it's not very good at campaigning either. I mean, I understand what you say, but if it was in campaign mode, the least one could expect, therefore, is a sort of pointed, coherent, halfway appealing set of messages. And I don't see those. Do you know what I mean? It's campaigning. It's governing in a confused way, and it's campaigning in a confused way as well.
I don't disagree with you, but I think that what they would say is that in our bubble here, that here is a group of people who probably all agree with the fact that the Rwanda strategy is frankly batshit, that they would say that once you get outside of the M25, you start finding a lot more people who don't think that and actually believe very, very strongly and passionately that that's something that they need to do. And that is why we are campaigning so solidly on it.
To no avail, though. The poll lead just stays exactly where it's been
well,
for 2 or 3 months.
Well, they would say, and this is not what I believe, but they would say that if you can get a plane taking off, that will change things. Personally, I think that's delusional. But they have persuaded themselves that if a plane does take off to Rwanda, that that could change their fortunes in the Red Wall seats.
All right, let me ask you both a question. Imagine you're in Downing Street now and it's your job to come out with a coherent message. In the middle of this shit show, what would the message be?
I can't come up with a coherent message for the Tories from here. I'm sorry, I can't.
I can imagine one. It might say, we're going to get the economy working. Inflation's coming down, which we'll talk about in a minute. You know, our aim is to cut your taxes and we will make sure the first plane takes off to Rwanda.
I think that their message is, look, whether we like it or not, Ukraine and COVID were major shocks. They caused huge problems to the economy. The economy is now going in the right direction. You know that we are focusing on the things like cutting your taxes, getting inflation down, that kind of thing. What we don't know is what the Labour Party is going to do. The Labour Party is staying incredibly stum about anything. You could write on the back of a postcard what we know that the Labour Party is going to do. So I think that that is the story that they want to tell. There's been a shock. We're the people who are dealing with it. Don't hand it to the other guys because we don't know what they're going to do.
But even the problem with that is that that's essentially a tidying of loose ends. I mean, and I agree that's the best strategy you could have at the moment. It says nothing about if you are aiming to get re-elected, you have to give, and this is one of the problems for Brown in 2010, you know, you have to give people a sense of what you're going to do with the next 4 or 5 years. It's like, what happens next? Not just we're going to deal competently with the problems that we've got at the moment. It's what do we see? How do we see the future turning out? What are the big unsolved problems? What are the big challenges that we're going to have to tackle? What are we going to do? You know, what we could do from here? And you hear almost nothing. I mean, even towards the end of the Cameron government, there was a lot of talk about, you know, coalition 2.0, never happened, you know, but there was looking forward to the future, to what a second term would bring, and there was a big idea for a second Cameron term. I have no idea what, I mean, I don't think Rishi Sunak even thinks he's going to have a second term.
Sunak, it could be said, had a bit of a boost this week with the news that inflation had fallen to 3.4%. The government's target is to get to 2% inflation, and they may reach it by the autumn. Do either of you think that that little bit of good news will have any effect on the government's standing?
I had dinner with the cabinet minister last week who was saying it's great because by the election we'll be down at our target of 2%, and next week it's going to be very low. The truth is, it's still going up. We've had this inflation shock that's really impacting people. Food price inflation is still very, very high. This idea that somehow people are going to go, thank you, inflation's coming down while prices are still rising, just seems to me to be slightly delusional as well.
Here's a last question. You mentioned you had dinner with the cabinet minister last week. I don't know who that was, but your friend David Cameron, contrary to the sense that he's in a government which is running out of steam, he seems full of vim. Doesn't seem like a zombie government from his perspective at all. He's loving it. There was a video did the rounds on social media of him walking down a staircase, energetically listing everything he'd done as if he was having a whale of a time.
Well, I'm just off for my first debate in the House of Lords after 100 days as Foreign Secretary, and my team set me the challenge to see if I could say all the things that I think we've done in the last 100 days since becoming Foreign Secretary. Well, I made 36 different visits to 26 different countries. I've spoken at 8 different multinational...
Well, I would say this, but I think that it was an inspired appointment. And I think what it's allowed is for Britain to really actually, post-Brexit, punch its way on the international stage. He's really leading the international community's response on Gaza. He's saying and doing a lot of interesting things. The Foreign Office is loving having somebody who can have pulling power in there. He is a bright spot in a quite gloomy outlook for this government.
Right, let's pause here for a minute. When we come back, we will be looking at the Labour Party, as I've said several times, and what it's going to do in this zombie 7 months.
In Norway, a woman's boyfriend forgets who she is overnight. In Detroit, a man is arrested, but he was never at the crime scene. In Spain, disturbing pictures of young girls have appeared, and no one knows who's behind them. Something strange is happening. A collision between people and artificial intelligence. Discover more in The Guardian's new series, Black Box. Listen wherever you get your podcasts. New episodes Monday and Thursdays.
Hallo, hier sind Julia und Chris vom Podcast Drinnies. Wir machen nicht nur einen Comedy-Podcast, sondern gehen auch leidenschaftlich gerne nicht zu Stoßzeiten in den Supermarkt. Ehrlich gesagt bleibe ich am liebsten ganz zu Hause und ziehe nur eine Hose an, wenn es klingelt. Wenn es euch auch so geht, dann ist HelloFresh genau das Richtige für euch. Der Kochbox-Lieferservice bringt euch frische, abwechslungsreiche Gerichte direkt vor die Haustür, die ihr im Handumdrehen selbst zubereiten könnt.
Und mit dem Code LECKER24 könnt ihr jetzt richtig sparen. In Deutschland bis zu 120 Euro, in Österreich bis zu 130 Euro und in der Schweiz bis zu 140 Franken. Also Code LECKER24 eingeben und sparen.
PS, der panierte Portobello-Pilz mit Sweet Chili Ketchup ist sehr gut.
Welcome back. We are now going to talk about the Labour Party. The longer we wait for Rishi Sunak to call a general election finally, the harder it might be, arguably, for the Labour Party to maintain such a hefty poll lead without messing up. A lot's been written about what I think Roy Jenkins, the 20th century Labour and SDP fella, called the Ming Vase approach. That is to say that opposition parties, and the Labour Party in particular, walk to power in a similar way to someone walking down a corridor with a Ming vase. They're increasingly terrified as time ticks by that they're going to drop it. And yeah, I guess you've seen this in the Labour Party's U-turn on its £28 billion green prosperity pledge. The fact that they talk endlessly about balancing the books and fiscal responsibility. They're very nervous and very, very cautious. And given 7 months, they might get even more cautious and terrified and throw even more policies overboard. You can see where I'm coming from, Gabby, can't you?
I can. And I think that's always a risk. But there's a flip side, which if you talk to some people in the Labour Party, would say that 7 months to them is more of a gift than it is to an embattled government, because still a bit rough around the edges in some quarters. There's still things that need ironing out. There's still things they could refine about their policies. There's still who goes where decisions to be made about cabinet. Yeah, I think they would see that they could use that 6 months quite constructively to prepare themselves for what I think we all know now is going to be a really, really difficult first few months in government. If you look at the things piling up in front of them, you'd certainly rather be them having that 6 months to prepare rather than Rishi Sunak having 6 months to try and hold a fractious party together.
But 7 months, Craig, of phony war. You said already that we're in a campaign, even though we're not in the official campaign. And I wonder whether, particularly if you're in opposition and the onus is on you to bounce around, be energetic and so on, there's therefore a real danger of burnout if a campaign lasts as long as it's threatening to.
As you get closer and closer to the election, there's going to be an endless demand for stories, interviews, that kind of thing. And if your small target strategy really is about saying nothing, that is just going to become really intense. There's two ways of looking at that. We say, look, this is a pain barrier we just have to go through. We do have to just basically not get to a problem and blow ourselves up. Let's just get to the line and then let's launch from there. The thing that I think is worrying about that is if they do have a secret plan that when they do eventually win and try and launch that on the public and they haven't really discussed it, that can cause all sorts of problems and issues going forward. So I think that they are being sort of tactically clever in the small target strategy, but strategically long term, is that going to be problematic? Maybe.
There's another historical comparison here, which is that Tony Blair didn't have that much of a sort of offer, if you think about it, in terms of what the Labour Party was proposing. But his character, the idea that he was sort of bouncing around, that he was constantly visible, that he was seen as interesting company, that sort of covered over the fact that he didn't have that much to say until he was in government. Keir Starmer was the opposite of that, right?
When you actually go back and look at the famous pledge card, it was very, very small things, but they managed to make a meal out of that. I do also think that one of the problems that Keir Starmer's facing, that Tony Blair didn't, was that did feel like a time of optimism, and a new Labour did a great job in doing that. But also the economy was brightening. Ken Clark was doing a good job in terms of making things happen. It felt like that there was a brighter future and the economy had been delivered, and therefore it was safe to go to the Labour Party. So that was the environment. At the moment, we're looking at an incredibly bleak picture for the economy and very, very limited information about what the Labour government would do. And one thing that would be nagging away at me if I was Labour is that it feels like it's a very anti-Tory vote out there at the moment rather than a pro-Labour vote. And also looking at Keir Starmer's popularity ratings, they are very low for an opposition leader that is about to become Prime Minister.
Let's talk about the other big face of Labour's front bench team. Rachel Reeves went one step further this week in marketing herself as the country's chancellor in waiting by giving a big speech to business and finance leaders. In the hour-long Mays lecture, Rachel Reeves set out her vision for a Labour government and promising to hardwire growth into the economy. This lecture is said to be a big moment. The previous speakers have included Gordon Brown, Norman Lamont, remember him, George Osborne and Rishi Sunak himself. So I wonder what we thought about what Rachel Reeves had to say. Let's just hear a bit of it.
We can no longer indulge complacency. A growth model reliant on geopolitical stability is a growth model resting on increasingly shallow foundations. The task, then, is to build for growth on strong foundations, broad-based, inclusive, resilient, and anchored in the realities of a fast-changing world.
Gabby, before we get to what she said, you have interviewed Rachel Reeves a number of times, I think.
A number of times, yeah.
She's obviously one of the most notable people having to endure this 7-month wait. What's she like?
The thing about Rachel I always struck by is, you know, she's a teacher's daughter. She is one of those, she's naturally kind of careful, she's conscientious, she likes to get things right. She's one of those people who, when she was revising for her GCSEs, almost certainly had a really neat revision schedule with everything done in different coloured highlighters. And I say that without criticism because I was the same. But, you know, there is a certain sort of girly swat aspect, definitely, to Rachel. But she's also, and I think what you see in this speech is her trying, I think, to combat this idea that, you know, because she and Keir Starmer are very alike in being quite cautious, quite careful people, you know, that doesn't have to mean boring. It doesn't have to mean nothing's going to change. It doesn't have to mean it's just the same, pretty much the same as the last government, except with slightly different looking people in charge. And I think what she's trying to do in that speech is to do two things: to move away from that idea that, you know, stability is boring. It's not about saying don't be radical. It's about saying build solid foundations for that. And the other thing I think she's trying to do is establish some credibility for herself as a female chancellor. You know, she would be the first female chancellor if she came in. I think that does come with some baggage, or it comes with an assumption that people don't necessarily immediately assume that you know what you're talking about in the same way they do when presented with a bloke in a suit talking about neo-endogenous growth theory. She goes, you know, there's a lot of deep references to things. Like, she wants you to know she's done the reading. She wants you to know she's done the thinking. She wants to evidence everything she's saying. And I think that is about establishing credibility.
Now, what she actually had to say about Margaret Thatcher in the speech was somewhat different from what was initially trailed. Right. Craig, that's a sort of quite a familiar sort of communications move on politicians' part, isn't it? They throw out something controversial to annoy their own side in advance of a big speech. Happens a lot in opposition. Did you see that familiarity there?
Yeah, to a point. I mean, I think she was trying to say, look, we've changed, we're different. 4 years ago, we were trying to persuade everybody that a revolutionary socialist should be prime minister. We couldn't be further from that now. And that she's basically got corporate Britain on side. There are CEOs of businesses now look at Rachel Reeves and think she's credible. She's not going to do anything crazy. What I do think is an issue is that there's an increasing view in corporate Britain as well that, you know, well, do you actually have an economic policy that is meaningful here? You're going to struggle to raise taxes because it will be so unpopular. You're faced by potential spending cuts. You're going to struggle to go to the bond markets and have a stable economy. So what are you going to do? What is your vision in that circumstance? And I don't think that after an hour of lecture yesterday, we were any closer to that. And I think that, yes, she's looking credible. And yes, she will be, you know, that people will welcome her and wish her well. But there is an increasing nagging worry about, do you really know what you're actually going to do here? Because it is really difficult circumstances and you haven't got the ability to just spend money.
But there's an easy answer to that on her part, isn't it? Which is that,
what?
Well, if you think we haven't got an answer, look at the government, right? And therefore...
Yeah, but that's fine until you're actually in government and become the government and then everybody's looking at you. And I just think that that is going to be a serious issue. That, you know, what are you going to do about public spending? Are you going to raise taxes? Do you seriously think you can credibly borrow? Because most people in the markets don't think you can borrow that much. It's a real issue. And then, so we keep hearing Securenomics. We hear Bidenomics, but we're not going to do the spending, which is a crucial part of Bidenomics. Okay, what is it? And I think that as over the next 7 months, I think if the Conservative Party are doing their job properly, they will turn the screw on that very, very hard.
And the Labour Party, presumably, Gabby, will sit tight because it wants to maintain that sort of small target strategy, and with a nod and a wink say something serious will happen after the election. That's certainly the sort of message that it's sending out to the likes of you and I, isn't it?
I don't know about that. I think there is an argument, certainly, especially if the election is 6-7 months away, and if you think about what's happened to the economy in 6 months periods recently, you know, I think there is an argument for saying the fine detail of tax and spend comes closer to the end. We've got another Tory budget, most likely before the election, which, I think they're not hiding the fact it's going to be a big tax cutting budget. That's going to some extent, you know, in the last budget, some of Labour's policies were nicked. You know, there is an argument against advancing any more policies just so that they can nick those as well. You know, so I think that's part of it. I think what was interesting to me about that speech, it wasn't a detailed speech at all. Greg is right. You know, you didn't really get much more of a sense of detail. But what you did get was the thing they're always criticised for. What's your big picture? What's vision? You know, the things that came out of that, her argument that the answer to populism is really an economic answer. You know, you don't win a culture war with more culture war. You win it by making people feel secure about their own lives, their jobs, their standard of living. But and coming back to the Thatcher point, she was making this very deliberate comparison. She wasn't saying, you know, Thatcher was great, we want a decade of renewal like Thatcher's. The comparison was between the situation Thatcher inherited in 1979, which was absolute chaos, you know, the economy on the floor, and the situation she'll inherit. It wasn't with what Thatcher did next. And I think you are going to hear more over the next few months about that kind of idea of what do you do with what you've inherited, which probably isn't going to be very uplifting.
Here's a question then. 7 months to go. At the moment, we know the state the polls are in. Craig, you talked about the fact that the one thing the Conservatives could do is say the Labour Party aren't telling you much and there's a great big question mark there and we're going to bang on and on about this and try and therefore sort of give the voters this message about uncertainty and you really don't know what you're getting and so on. Do you think the polls will tighten or do you think a Labour landslide is by far the race in certainty?
I think that there is definitely going to be a situation where Keir Starmer is Prime Minister. There's a huge debate going on in polling at the moment. Is it the kind of MRP version, which says that there's going to be a majority of 250, or is it the kind of people who believe in a unified swing across the country a bit and think that it's actually going to be much tighter? Traditionally, the polls do tighten a little bit. But look, the reality is it would take an extraordinary miracle for Keir Starmer to be Prime Minister in 2025. I mean, for Rishi Sunak to be Prime Minister in 2025.
I feel the same. It feels at the moment like everybody, you know, you look at the polls, we're heading for total wipeout. And there's a small voice inside you going, no, that isn't going to happen. It isn't going to happen like that. It is going to narrow. Surely those aren't right. And it does feel as if things will narrow a bit.
Life is rarely that simple. Thank you both for joining us.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And thank you for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's episode. You know what I'm going to say next? If you did, make sure you subscribe to Politics Week in the UK, wherever you get your podcast. Before you go, please check out The Guardian's new series on artificial intelligence. It's called Black Box, and each episode follows a different story. In the final episode of the series, it's asking, could AI be the end of humanity? I rather hope not. Search and subscribe to Black Box wherever you get your podcast. This episode of Politics Week in the UK was produced by Frankie Toby. The music is by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producers are Maz Ebtahaj and Nicole Jackson.
This is The Guardian.